Mr. Lingard, Real 10. We're talking about when you were first out.
First out of the service altogether. And not very comfortable with the people outside. As my leave hadn't finished, I was still wearing my uniform on most occasions. I didn't fare well wearing turned-up trousers with very narrow bottoms, a waistcoat and a tie. These things I never seemed to settle in. And I didn't seem to get on outside very well with, but my brother had a small business, a small sports business.
What were you to do for work?
Well, prior to that, I used to work in a garage, you see, as a grease monkey, a trainee mechanic. I could have gone back to that firm, which everybody went back to the firms they'd left when they were called up. But I didn't want to go back into that.
Why not?
I'd aged a few years in experience. I didn't fancy it. I'd been used to being out in the fresh air for the last few years.
You didn't fancy garage work?
I didn't fancy going back into the garage with all the fumes and the dirt and the greasy hands. And my brother says, I'd got me, what do they call it, the money you finished with, the gratuity. I finished with, I got me gratuity, a few pounds I'd saved and a few quid my mother had left me. Got a few pound in the Birmingham Municipal Bank. I remember that, which doesn't exist now. And I got a few quid in that. And my brother said, well, why don't you come and join the firm? You know, he'd got a few girls. He got about a dozen girls working for him in this sports business, manufacturing stuff. And I thought, well, why not? So what money I'd got, I sunk into his business. And I become not a partner, but working for him. And
what were you actually doing?
I was stringing tennis rackets from machining and manufacturing barrels for darts, bass barrels, in a machine shop, which I didn't like.
So you were just working as a machinist?
Yeah,
the rest?
And that I didn't like. So he said, well, why don't you go on the road? And I said, right. So I went back to turned up trousers, a waistcoat and a trilby, and went out on the road.
Selling
sports equipment. And to be honest today, I was selling rubbish. And that's all I was manufacturing, was rubbish. From footballs to football shin pads, football boots, football stockings, darts, dart boards, even domino sets, anything at all that was to do with recreational sports. I had a case full of them, and I used to cart this round, and I thought, this is a waste of time. I'm not sleeping in hotels, I'm sleeping in little boarding houses, you know, at a few bob a night.
So how long did you stick that for?
About less than a year. And I thought, I was in the Birmingham area then, and I was visiting most of the sport. I always remember one I went into in Corporation Street, Birmingham, Parks's Sports Equipment and Works. And they sold everything. And I went in there. I'd done been there once or twice selling different things. And it was rubbish, really. And I come out of there. Got a small order, I think, for something. Come out of there, and I was in Birmingham, and I was looking at the recruiting offices, and I thought, I think I'd be better off going back in the Navy. When I went back to the Naval Recruiting Office there, and they said, oh, you know, yes, we could take you back in, you know, told them what I was. And they said, no, we could train you as a cook. And I said, no, they started this bloody years ago. I don't want to be a cook. And they said, no. Anyway, they said, really, you know, we want people a little bit younger than you now. And we'd really train them on as coders or cooks or whatever it was. And I said, no, no. Anyway, I came out, and right next door to it was the RAF recruiting office. So I thought, well, we'll try that. So I walked in the Naval in the RAF recruiting office and spoke to a young sergeant there. And he says, you want to join up? And I said, yeah. He says, So I put him through what I'd done, and I'd been in the Navy. I didn't tell him what I did in the Navy, just said I'd been in the Royal Navy throughout the war, and I'd come home and I was a bit disillusioned, and the Navy didn't want me back. I says, oh, they'll join the Air Force. Yes, he says, you'll be quite welcome. So he says, can you come in a few days' time and have a medical? And I said, yes. So he says, where do you live? And I said, well, I'm living at Warsaw at the moment with my brother. And he says, well, have you got a local doctor? I said, no. Okay, he says, we'll fix up with the medical here. So he says, can you come back tomorrow? And I said, yes. So the following day I went there and they fixed me up locally with the doctor. He gave me the bus fare to get on a Midland Red bus, go to this doctor's address. I had a medical and that was all. I said, yeah, okay. You'll have more medicals than that, though. And then they said, would you come back in another few days? And I went back again about another four or five days. And they said, yes, we got your medical report off the doctor and, you know, everything's all right. And we'll send you for an RAF medical now. And I said, where are you going to send me for that? I says, it's only upstairs. You're not the only one. And when I went upstairs, there was about six fellas all sitting there. I was waiting for a medical with an RAF doctor. So I went in front of him and had the usual medical, told him the story about the Navy, and he said, yeah, okay, he's all right, you know. No problem. Took all the paperwork back downstairs, and I said, okay, we'll call you up in about 9 weeks' time.
When would this be? End of 46 or 47?
End of 46, yeah.
End of 46. Yeah.
And I said, no. I said, I don't want to be hanging around here all those weeks. And I said, well, when would you like to be called up? And I said, whenever you're ready. So I said, okay, then, yeah, fine. About 3 weeks, that's about the shortest we can do. And I said, yeah, all right then. So then I went home. Now, up until then, never told my brother about this. I just said I was fed up of going around the country, you know, Northampton, Leicester, and all the rest of it, fed up of that. And it was about 3 weeks later, I had my papers come to report to Cardington, RAF Cardington in Bedfordshire.
That'd be December 46.
Mm.
And what happened at Cardington?
Well, I caught the train and went to Cardington, reported there, the usual place, and they said yes. Of course, I was still in my civilian clothes, and up until then, nobody knew I'd already been in the Navy. I had no naval tattoos on me, which I didn't believe in. I thought it was rubbish. So therefore, they thought I was just a chap that had been at home throughout the war, and I'd just joined up. So they issued me with a uniform, and they put me in a squad there, and I was doing...
What was the uniform like? How did it compare? What did you think?
Rough, very rough compared with the Navy one, and I wasn't used to wearing a collar and tie. You know, I was forever putting my fingers and stretching it. I wasn't used to wearing a collar and tie. And I got the usual boots. I was back in boots again now. The first year in the Navy, I only wore boots. After that, I wore shoes. You bought your own. And I wore shoes. So I was back in boots again with the RAF. But I still had my civilian clothes in a case, you see. And then...
And what were you doing at RAF Cardington?
Drill. I was learning all about the routine of the Royal Air Force and what they were going to train me as.
What were they training you as?
Nothing at the moment. I was still just a trainee and I was learning how to march and how to run, how to do PT. And after spending them years in the Navy, it come no hardship to me, you know. And being told what to do come as no hardship. So...
Was the drill any different?
Vastly different.
In what way?
The rifle drill was different. The present arms was entirely different. And the drill was different altogether. Marching was exactly the same. And it come pretty easy because I'd been used to it after being in the Navy, being at HMS Excellent. Being shouted at come quite easy, you know. Didn't worry me at all. Worried some of the young lads. But I hadn't been there... I think you had 2 months training, I'm not sure. But I'd been there a couple of weeks, and you'd come on the standing orders that if you had any medal ribbons at all, you had to wear them, and they were issued, you see. So you had to go to the stores. So I went to the local stores in there, the RAF stores, and they looked up, and they said, oh, yeah, we got all your records. They're using the Navy. Yeah, okay. Have you got any medal ribbons? And I said, no. Well, I hadn't got them with me. I'd, you know... discarded them somewhere along the line. Anyway, a few days later, I was sent for, and I went down the office there, and they says, "Here, here's your issue of medals and your medal ribbons." And I got a whole issue, and I got about six. I thought, I'm sure entitled to all these, you know. And I've got this whole row there, and I says, "Okay, there, sew your ribbons onto your battle dress, and the medals are only worn on ceremonial parades." So I was quite pleased about that. So I went back, and I sewed all my medals up, you know, the whole row of them. The North African one, the Italian one, the Atlantic one, the one that started the war and the finish of the war, about six, I think there was altogether. They had them all rowed, France and Germany, from being in the Bay of Biscay. I sewed them all up, you see, and the next morning on parade, in those days it was a case of on parade, and the shortest was in the middle, and the tallest was on the left and right. This is how you fell in. And there's all row of us there, all young recruits. And the drill sergeant was there, and he was an Irishman. And he looked along it, and his eyes focused on me. And he called me out in front of all these people while they're wagging his finger at me. Called me out, and he said, put his face very close, and he says, "You are not allowed to wear your father's medal ribbons. Go and take them off." And I said, "They're not my father's medal ribbons, they are mine." And he says, "I don't believe you." So I took my pay book out, and that was all written in my pay book. And he says, "Get off this parade, and I don't want to see you on here again. Move." I'd never done a parade after that. I thought it was great. I thought, you know, life's lovely, no more parades. And I was still waiting for the training course to finish. So I had nothing to do all day, only hang around. Various lessons that they went on, particularly aircraft recognition, I used to avoid that like the plague I had. So I used to go off down the local pub, Brickwood Sunshine Ales, I think it was. I think it was outside the pub, Brickwood Sunshine Ale. I used to go down there. And coming back one day, walking back, there was a young officer there. A young RAF officer got his head bent over a little MG, and I just walked up and said, "Excuse me, see, have you got a problem?" And he said, "The bloody thing stopped." And I says, "Petrol?" "Oh," he says, "petrol's all right." He says, "Oh, yeah," he says, "petrol for Gates is all right anyway." I said, "Well, lift the bonnet and let's have a look." So he says, "You know anything about engines?" And I said, "I ain't got a clue, but lift up, we might find something." So I lifted the bonnet with this MG and had a look. Everything, plugs were all wired up, everything seemed all right. Switched it on, nothing happened. The engine just went, "Oh, whoa, 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 whoa," nothing happened. And I took the distributor cap off and I said, "Have you got a nail file?" Anyway, out come a little case and he found me a little nail file. And I rubbed it between the contact breakers. Put the cap back on and I said, "Give it a pull." He pushed the start, he burst into life. "Oh," he says, "you're a mechanic." And I says, "No." I says, "It's just the fact that the points were stuck." I said, "And just put your nail file between them, clean the soot and burn off." I said, "They're all right." So he said, "Where are you going?" I says, "Back to the camp." "Jump in," he says, "so give me a lift." On the way back to the camp, he says, "Can you drive?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we're looking for a CO's driver." He said, "The CO's driver at the moment is sick." He said, "Do you think you'd do that?" I said, "Certainly." He says, "You've been in a long time, haven't you?" And I says, "Why?" He said, "Those medal ribbons." I said, "No, I've only just joined." He said, "Where'd you get all that stuff from?" I said, "Been in the Navy." "Oh," he said, "just the job." So we got back there, and I got CO's driver, and that was a piece of cake.
What did you have to do as CO's driver?
Mostly taking his wife and his kids to school. That was the most important, first thing in the morning, that was. I used to pick him up, first of all, get in the car from the MT yard. And when you were CO's driver, nobody bothered you. Pick the car up, down to his house, because he lived in a large house, which was rented by the RAF. Pick him up, take him back to the camp, go back and pick his wife up and take the kids to school. Take his wife shopping, and then go back and do any duties he wanted me to do. Dinner time was the same thing, take him home for lunch in the car. Me have a sandwich in the kitchen, you see, and go at 4 o'clock and pick his kids up from school. It was a great job, that, lovely.
How long were you there from late 46 into 47?
Oh, yeah, into 47, and I was there till about halfway through 47. I was there quite some time.
Had your training course finished?
My training course had finished. I passed with flying colours. I hadn't even done nothing at all. Only driving. And they said, his official driver came back then, and they said, as I say, drill come easy to me. It was no problem being drill, and I enjoyed it. And I was reasonably smart in those days. And they said, what we'll do, we'll send you on a crane course. Because they'd learnt I'd been in the Navy, and they assumed that being in the Navy, you learnt all about cranes, you learnt all about ropes and splicing, wire splicing ropes. And they thought, great, we'll send you on a crane course. I'll send me to RAF Garstang, which is north of Blackpool. So up to RAF Garstang, I went to on a course there. And I got on all right at this course. It was great. I enjoyed it.
Tell us a bit about it.
Well, the usual thing there was a lot of rugby league went in that part of the country, and they said, oh, being in the Navy, you know, you probably played football. And would you like? I said, no, rugby league I could not stand. I didn't mind rugby union, but not rugby league. I think it was a bit bullish, that. And a very hard game, too. Anyway, while I was there, they said, I went on this course, learning to drive a crane, which come pretty easy. And then they sent me from there, when I passed that course, they sent me to the Royal Air Force Station at Ashbourne in Derbyshire, to an MT section there. And that was a bomb disposal unit. And I was on bomb disposal unit there from Moni Ash, a little village outside there where all the bombs were stored. Moni Ash, and we was on bomb disposal.
You were on a bomb disposal team?
On a bomb disposal team. What we used to do there was the bombs had started to crystallise by then and started to sweat. And we used to load them into cradles, put them onto low loaders.
You were working as a crane driver?
Yeah, yeah. And then ship these off to Liverpool for deep sea dumping. That's what they used to do with them. God knows where they used to dump them at sea. Used to be on this convoy work there to Liverpool. We used to go about once every 2 weeks, I should think, with a convoy of low loaders. They used to call them Queen Marys, you know, long ones.
Lorries.
Queen Marys. And that was mostly AEC lorries or Leylands.
Is it dangerous work or...?
We didn't think so, but everybody used to think so. We had little red flags stuck all over the bloody vehicles, you know, red. And we had police escorts. Every time we went through, the officer in charge used to ring up the various police and say, we're passing through there. We had a police escort all the way to Liverpool, through every town. Once we was out in the country, the police used to turn back and turn us over to another lot for the next town. They used to block off the traffic lights. Traffic lights were all red, and we used to go straight the way through them. And we thought it was good, you know.
What happened when you got to Liverpool?
Going to the docks, and then the dockers there, the crane drivers, they used to unload it. We used to supervise the unloading of it. And that was dropped into cradles, and eventually they went on ships then, whatever. They were never loaded straight onto a ship. They were put on the dockside, they had to be examined and passed, whatever that was. I suppose if they'd crystallised too much, they get the people in to disarm them.
But so they were dangerous, but not that dangerous?
Not dangerous. No, they were dangerous, but not that dangerous. You weren't allowed to drop the damn things anyway.
You were doing this from 47, mid-47?
Yeah.
To when?
Oh, I wasn't there long. I was there about at Ashbourne on Domish. I was there about a year, I should think. Or probably less than a year at Ashbourne.
To 48, though?
Mm. And,
Anything happen?
No, while I was there, they...
What was your rank? I mean, were you just known as a crane driver, or did you...
No, there, I was an LAC, leading aircraftsman. But while I was at Ashbourne, they decided that I knew so much about all this, you know, loading lorries and unloading and things like that. They said, the best thing you do is, we'll put you on a corporal's course. So I went on a corporal's course and become a fully-fledged corporal in a very short while. And that's when they updated my rank then to a corporal.
Does that make much difference to you?
It made a difference in my money, yes, but it also made another difference then, because at that particular time they wanted some crane instructors, and they decided I would be one of them. So then they said, okay, we're going to send you to Germany as a crane instructor. And there was another corporal there, Corporal Perry. He was on bomb disposal, the same as me. And they chose him and I to go to Germany. At the very last moment, they changed it and sent us to Egypt. So we ended up at...
Still as a crane instructor.
Still as a crane instructor. We ended up at 51 MT Company, El Amra, in Egypt. We ended up there. At El Amra. El-Hamra, H-A-M-R-A. El Amra. Apparently out there it means the Red Hills or
Where's
something.
It's
in between Port Said and Cairo. It's top end. It's the bottom end of the Suez Canal near Port Tufik.
Now you were going as so you were as a crane instructor.
I was a crane instructor then.
What was the setup out there?
Well, when we got there, they decided the two corporals who would come on this training instruction business, they would fly out to various camps and teach young ones how to operate these cranes. Because this was after the war, and they'd be out in the desert.
This was 48.
Yeah, recovering. RAF stuff and aircraft that would crash and all the rest of it. That's what they thought would happen. And they sent us to a place which is well known in the paper today, Basra. And we flew out to Basra, and what a place that was. I didn't like it at all. It was terrible. Basra RAF camp. Anyway, we was there for... It was a three-week course, really, to teach these people how to operate a crane and to, you know... How to sling bombs and pick up stuff and rope splice and that. After 3 weeks, we was flown back to El Amra. We hadn't got a flying station at El Amra, but they'd got one RAF Fayed, which was an RAF station, which was just over the road from us. So we was flown back there, and when I got there, I went in to see the commander of the camp, which is Squadron Leader Gimmel, a Scotchman. And on his desk, he was a great bloke. On his desk, he got a burnt screen there, and written on it was, "Work is the curse of the drinking class." And I always remember that. And he'd got this on his desk there, and he was a Scotchman. He was an old man, but he was great company. And I said, "Look, this is a waste of time flying us out to teach two people. You're sending two corporals out there to teach two younglings how to operate a crane. Why don't we start a school here and bring them in here from various depots?" He says, "A good idea, organise it." And he was left at that. So we said, "Well, where are we going to find a classroom? We all live in bloody tents here." So he says, "Well, you know, they call them porter cabins today." So we found out that one of the army camps, they got some of these porter cabins, and they said, you know, Montgomery used to use one of these, towed all around the country when he was out here during the war. So we confiscated two of these porter cabins on wheels, towed them back to the camp, and we set up one as a classroom and one as an office. As the people come in, and we asked if we could have no less than six pupils coming every time, up to 10, between 6 and 10. So Perry and I, we decided one of us would do the classroom instruction and one would do the practical work outside of picking up various bombs and, you know, how to sling various equipment. So I said, "I'll do the classroom stuff if you like. I didn't want to be out in the sun all morning." So I picked up the classroom stuff and I taught rope splicing, wire splicing, brake adjustments on the cranes. Taught them all this. I'd do all diagrams all around the classroom. There was diagrams of the various types. There was the American cranes that we had. There was Coles cranes, the British ones. And we had all these around the classroom. And this used to take 3 weeks to teach them all this. Don't forget, we only worked in the morning from 6 till midday. Midday we packed up. No work after that. So it went on like that. And that was pretty good, that was. We both enjoyed that.
And you were always in the classroom?
Always in the classroom. And, of course, as the time went on, some of the operators, they couldn't even drive, so we had to teach them to drive as well. So I become a crane instructor and a driving instructor too while I was out there. So I become a driving instructor.
What would you teach them?
We were teaching them anything from small staff cars and teach them up to Coles cranes, up the old lot. which was about 10 to, and we used to teach them to drive heavy vehicles, Leyland Hippos, you know, 8-wheel vehicles, 6-wheel vehicles. We used to teach them that as well. And that became an easy job after a while, you know, and we got on quite well.
What were living conditions like at El Hamra?
Living conditions were very good. We lived in tents. One day I'll sort out my photographs of the tents we lived in, and they were good. Mine was exceptionally good tent, mine was. It was very clean, very tidy. Looked like a small bungalow by the time I'd finished building it up. One day I'll sort all these photographs out and show them to you.
So pretty comfortable tent. What about the food?
The food was good in the RAF. And of course out there you didn't have to wash your own shirts and that, you know. You had a dobe lad who used to come and collect all your shirts and your collars and your shorts and your long whites, you know. He used to do all that for you. So domestic-wise, it was dead easy. It was lovely. The food was very good. And of course, when we used to go around with some of the WAF girls. They were very nice, very nice. There was none on our camp, but there was some of the camp over the road. RAF Fayed, there was a lot of WAFs out there. We got on very well. The good dance halls out there, you know. They organised everything much better.
That's where you met your wife, isn't it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I met her at Ashbourne first. I didn't know very well at Ashbourne. But she was going to be posted to Germany, and that was changed. She was posted to Egypt. She was posted to Ishmaelia. And she thought, better the devil you know than the one you don't know. And she knew I was out there, so she made some inquiries and said, he's a drill instructor. And they said, well, if he's a Coles crane instructor, he'll be at 51 MT Company, which was the biggest in the Middle East. So she rang up, and then one day there was a chap there phoned me, and he says, hey, there's a WAF wants you on the phone. And I thought, it was a girl from over the road, and it wasn't, it was Joan. And she says, I'm in this country now. I said, where are you? She said, I'm at Ishmaelia, which was about 10 miles up the road. And I said, oh, great. She said, well, I know you, I don't know many, because girls were very short, and I don't know many people out here, only the girls I've come out with. I said, okay, I'll come up and see you tonight. So, of course, I went up in a crane, 10-ton crane. You know, you could, you got a pass to take these cranes out any time. She said, oh, I borrowed the crane and went out there. And when caught in a crane, I was taken out there, went to a dance hall, parked the crane in the car park. And nobody ever bothered you coming out the camp, you know. You got a pass to take a crane out, nobody knew where you were going. And it was quite easy at the time we had. We had a good time, Joan and I, out there. And, of course, to cut the story a bit shorter, when she wanted to come home, towards the end of it, she wanted to come home. Her mother was very ill, so she had to come home. So then we got married, and she says, will you marry me before I go home? And I said, yeah, okay. So, of course, I had to go and ask squadron leader Gemmell if I could get married. He was a commanding officer. So I went and asked him, and I says, you know, and he says, do you know the girl? And I said, yes. He said, how long have you known? And I said, well, it's like this, sir. I said, I've known her a long time. We used to pee in the same drain. Oh, he said, that's good enough. That's good enough, he said, certainly. And he signed the application to get married.
And what year were you married?
Hmm?
What year were you married?
I was, what were I?
What year?
What? Oh, God, 1951. 1951. I always remember because I was in 51 MT Company, so we got married in 1951. I can't forget that.
So you just carried on in this routine out there, really?
Yeah.
Instructing these courses of overs, you know.
Learning to drive on coaches. From coaches to small staff cars to cranes. There's only two corps. We had a sergeant, but he never used to be bothered about things like that. He used to run other things. But we used to do out the reports for him to send off to their various camps if they'd passed the courses, you know, passed the driving course, if they'd passed the crane lifting course. And
how did you get on with the Egyptians?
We didn't get on with them very well. As long as they could scrounge stuff off us, that was all right. But nobody trusted them at all out there.
What would they do?
Well, they used to break into the camp at night sometimes, and sometimes one or two got knocked about a little bit. Not Egyptians, the servicemen.